Chapter 20. Dominance. The scene is your local bar room any night after work. You and some of the boys have got together for a few quick ones before going home. There are four or five of you sitting at a table sipping beer, exchanging anecdotes, telling jokes. Suddenly, someone you all know, let's call him Dennis, walks in from the street and strides up to the counter. He orders his drink and stands eyeing your party as if he were thinking of making a bid for you. Then, without being told to or being able to stop yourselves, you all find yourselves on your feet. You hurry over to Dennis. You ask him how he's keeping, what sort of day he's had, what his drink is. He didn't come and sit down with you. You went up and collectively joined him. What has just happened, whether you realise it or not, is a case of dominance. Dennis, the dominator, has asserted his power, his influence upon you. You don't know why it happened or how it happened. It just did. That's what dominance is all about. The human animal has reacted as though compelled, brainwashed, or in some mysterious way hypnotised. In order to understand and to recognise this social phenomenon, it's first of all necessary to examine the way in which dominance operates among the birds and the animals. Everyone who's ever kept chickens has noticed the existence of the pecking order. It is as if each chicken carried a number around its neck. Number 10 is allowed to peck number 11, or any higher number, but has to submit quietly if number 9 chooses to deliver an admonishing peck. And the pecking order appears to be a law of nature that appears in most tribes of wild animals. A television film made by the naturalist Jane Goodall on the wild dogs of Africa showed that the leader need not necessarily be male. The pack was led by a female who exercised complete authority over dogs of both sexes. But what is perhaps the most important discovery about dominance was not made by any single naturalist. It has simply emerged quietly until it's now generally recognised. It is this, that among all animal groups, the number of highly dominant ones seems to be the same, an average of 5%. The explorer Sir Henry Stanley knew about it at the turn of the century, for when Bernard Shaw asked him how many men could lead his party if he himself became ill, Stanley replied promptly, 1 in 20. When Shaw asked if this was an exact or approximate figure, Stanley replied, exact. He was referring to the will to power, to dominate, to succeed, which tallied with Shaw's own frequently expressed theory of the life force, the inner drive which leads us, all the more dominant among us, to success in our jobs and professions. It was Robert Ardrey, the American author of African Genesis, who first gave publicity to the 1 in 20 theory. Ardrey's research showed him that one of the most closely guarded secrets of the Korean War was that no escapes were made by American prisoners. This was because their Chinese captors had discovered an infallible method of preventing breakouts. They observed the prisoners carefully for a while, and then removed the dominant ones, the 5% who were leader figures, and put them in a separate compound under heavy guard. Once the leaders were removed, the other prisoners became far easier to handle. In fact, they could be left with almost no guard at all. The Chinese observed that the number of dominant prisoners was always exactly 1 in 20. The Nazis recognised the significance of this when, during World War II, they placed all the most incorrigible escapers together in escape-proof prisons like Colditz. More recently, in Britain, the 1966 Commission into Prison Reform, headed by Lord Louis Mountbatten, recommended that the more dangerous convicts were not split up among a large number of prisons, but were kept together. So far, however, no zoologist has conducted careful research to establish why the dominant minority appears to be 5%. A study should be made of leading surgeons, ministers, politicians, sportsmen and pop stars to ascertain whether or not they form 5% of their profession, or, indeed, separate 5% of the population. Obviously, it's not only criminals who are dominant, and Ardrey defines dominance as occurring when two or more animals, or humans, pursue the same activity. The view is also held that crooks only become crooks because their willpower is frustrated or denied in some way, thus rechanneling their efforts to succeed into antisocial areas. One of the few countries where official figures are available is Russia, where the Communist Party of the Soviet Union contains approximately 5% of all the people, 14.5 million members out of a population of 242 million. In the US, scientific probes have been made into the whole question of dominance, and the researchers of John B. Calhoun of the National Institute of Mental Health at Bethesda, Maryland, threw up one of the most disturbing observations on the subject of power over others. Calhoun wanted to observe the behaviour of rats under conditions of overcrowding. A large number of rats were placed in three interconnecting cages. The king rat took over the central cage for himself and his harem. The other rats were forced into the other two cages, so that they were now grossly overcrowded. And the dominant 5% quickly became a criminal 5%. These criminal rats did things that are never seen among rats in nature. Rats have an elaborate and self-protecting courting ritual, but these rodents wandered around in gangs, raping any spare females they chanced upon. They also became cannibals, eating the baby rats. Here, then, it seems we have an immediate explanation of the high crime rate in the slum areas of our great cities. Overcrowding produces a kind of violent opportunism among the dominant 5%. One of the Cray twins, the brothers who in the 1960s ruled over the crime kingdom of London's East End, said that in their environment, crime was the only way to get somewhere. The state of mind produced by overcrowding leads to an attitude of desperation, which in turn leads the weaker members of society to become even weaker, and so to disappear or go under. Female rats, for example, tend to abort, while the dominant ones become even more violent, grabbing at whatever food or sex they want. Under these conditions, all sense of leisure vanishes. Crimes become brutal and pointless. The dominant children may also become criminals. An item in the World Press for November 1972 stated briefly that two boys, aged 11 and 12, had been arrested in New York for raping a 7-year-old girl and then throwing her to her death from the roof of a tenement in which they lived. It was the overcrowded rat syndrome, seen in human terms. From the point of view of the emerging new criminology, it makes no difference whether the dominant minority is 5% or 4% or 6%. All that is important is to recognise that in any society there is a small group whose dominance is definitely higher than that of the others, and that, under conditions of stress, this dominance may express itself in crime. A graphic example of this occurred on a warm June evening in 1956, when the chief forester of Buderich, a village near Dusseldorf, was out patrolling some woods in which a number of courting couples had recently been attacked and murdered. Suddenly he came across a man crouching in the bushes holding a revolver. In a clearing a few yards away, two lovers were kissing in a parked car. The forester, who was armed, succeeded in arresting the peeping Tom, and then took him to Buderich police station. There the prisoner identified himself as Werner Bust, a 28-year-old mechanic from Dusseldorf. It was while criminal commissar Eink was interviewing Bust that his secretary rang to say that a man named Franz Lorbach wanted to see him. Lorbach was a small man, pale, with a weak chin, and what he wanted to report was that Werner Bust was a mass murderer. Eink quotes him as saying, "He's a monster, an ogre, I'm in his power, hypnotised by him, he forces me to do things I don't want to." He told Eink that for more than 3 years, Bust had been preying on courting couples in the woods. At first he only robbed them while Lorbach looked on. Then he began forcing the couples to take drugs that would stupefy them, and he and Lorbach would rape the women. One car they approached in January 1953 contained two men, although Bust did not realise this until he'd wrenched open the driver's door and shot the driver, a Dr. Survey through the head. He ordered Lorbach to kill the other man, but Lorbach couldn't do it. He whispered to the man to lie down and sham dead, and then struck him with the butt of the gun. In November 1955 and February 1956, there were two more murders of courting couples in the Dusseldorf area. Friedhelm Beer and Thea Kuhrmann were battered unconscious. The girl was raped. Then the car was pushed into a disused quarry filled with water, where they drowned. Peter Falkenberg and Hildegard Klassing were killed more elaborately. He was shot and she was given an injection of cyanide. Then their car was driven into a haystack and burned. Bust denied everything, but ballistic evidence proved that he was the killer of Dr. Servet, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. If Lorbach's account of Bust's crimes is even half true, then Werner Bust is Germany's most spectacular criminal since Peter Curtin, the Dusseldorf sadist and mass murderer who was executed in 1931. In retrospect, this relationship with Lorbach is the strangest aspect of the case. Bust was a loner, A man, according to Lorbach, possessed by feelings of malevolence towards the human race. To him, killing a human being is no different to slaughtering an animal. He didn't need an accomplice, and even if he did, Lorbach was the worst choice he could have made. Lorbach was a coward and an incompetent. Once, when he'd failed to kill a female cashier on Boost's orders, he paid Boost about 600 marks as compensation. Einck describes Lorbach as having a face like a rabbit. Boost bound Lorbach to him by giving him drugs, which may help to explain Lorbach's unwilling slavery. But it doesn't explain why Boost wanted such a companion. The evidence seems to indicate that in some odd way Boost needed Lorbach as much as Lorbach needed Boost. More, perhaps, since Lorbach hated his servitude and wanted to escape. It was this kind of strange and seemingly inexplicable relationship that in 1936 fascinated a young Jewish psychologist called Abraham Maslow. Maslow spent hours watching the monkeys in the Bronx Zoo in New York. Their behaviour puzzled him. To begin with, they seemed to think of nothing but sex. "The screwing went on all the time," said Maslow. But that was more or less explainable to a Freudian. After all, Freud had asserted that sex is the basic impulse in all animals. What baffled Maslow in this simian Sodom and Gomorrah was that male apes mounted other males. Females mounted other females, and on occasion, females even mounted males. Were they all wantons? And then one day the answer struck him. It was always the highly dominant apes that mounted the less dominant ones, and it made no difference whether they were male or female. He was witnessing the ape equivalent of the pecking order. This made Maslow interested in the whole phenomenon of dominance. Maybe Freud was wrong about the importance of sex. The logical thing, Maslow decided, was to study dominance in women, the naturally undominant sex. Between 1937 and the early 40s, he made careful case studies of nearly 200 women. The results, when he published them, were so startling that psychologists didn't know what to make of them. What was so remarkable was that the women seemed to fall quite clearly into three groups, which Maslow labelled high dominance, medium dominance, and low dominance. High dominance women tended to be highly sexed. Most of them masturbated without feeling guilt. They enjoyed sexual experimentation. They were promiscuous. Many had lesbian experience. In order to achieve full sexual satisfaction, these women needed a highly dominant male. One highly dominant woman was a nymphomaniac, who could have an orgasm just by looking at a man. Yet with one male, she had not been able to achieve a climax, because I just couldn't respect him. Medium dominance women tended to be gentle souls, altogether less experimental. They wanted to marry Mr. Right, and they looked for a kind, thoughtful man who would be a good home builder. In courtship, they liked soft music and soft lights and romance. Highly dominant males frightened them and struck them as brutal. Low dominance women did not really like sex at all. They thought it was dirty, to be indulged in only for the purposes of producing children. They considered the male sex organ to be crude and ugly. High dominance women found it beautiful. Low dominance women wanted the kind of man who would admire them from a distance. One interesting point to emerge was that all women preferred a man of slightly higher dominance than themselves, not too domineering, or he frightened them. In keeping with this, high dominance males tended to find medium dominance females sentimental and sloppy. As to low dominance women, well, they might take them to bed, given the chance, but they would never experience much personal involvement. A couple in history who appeared to have shared the right and mutually satisfying domination relationship were the Duke and Duchess of Marlborough. The Duke was a professional soldier, renowned for his brilliant use of mobility and firepower. He gained a number of famous victories, the most notable being his defeat of the French and Bavarians at the Bavarian village of Blenheim in 1704. On returning home from these triumphs, he found that dominance and sex went together as naturally as powder and shot, and his wife, the Duchess, contentedly recorded in her diary, "My lord returned from the war today and pleasured me twice in his top boots." In the sphere of crime, dominance-based partnerships are usually of a lethal and destructive nature. When a high-dominance personality with criminal tendencies decides to form an alliance with a medium-dominance personality, simply for the pleasure of having a slave and disciple, the result can be highly explosive. For crime is a way of asserting dominance, and the submissiveness of the slave leads the master to seek out new ways of expressing his power. The history of crime is full of these relationships between high and medium dominance personalities. Apart from two cases dealt with in this book, Granite Woman, Ruth Snyder, and her corset salesman lover Judd Gray, and Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, the British Moors murderers, there are many examples of a warped relationship between a highly dominant criminal and a mainly undominant accomplice. The partnership of Martha Beck and Raymond Fernandez, a petty confidence swindler who specialised in swindling love-hungry American widows out of their savings, became internationally known as the Lonely Hearts Killers. Martha, a fat and oversexed nurse, was also a dominant and unpleasant personality. She had been deprived of the custody of her children for ill-treating them, but she was not a criminal. And it was Martha who decided to join Fernandez in his swindling activities, and who also decided that the victim should die so that they couldn't complain. But the Manson case is certainly the most bizarre example of dominance murder. When Charles Manson came to San Francisco in 1967, he was 33 years old and had spent most of his adult life in jail for petty crimes. Later publicity portrayed him as a demonic, Svengali-like figure with smouldering eyes. In fact, he attracted followers by his gentleness, charm and intelligence. There was something of the Charlie Chaplin tramp about him, the slightly comic man of sorrows, permanently bullied by the world. Like Brady and Loeb, he preached a Superman philosophy, derived mainly from a science fiction novel by the American author Robert Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land. The disciples gathered round, and Manson, whose name, as one of his girls pointed out, meant man's son, led them around California like a new messiah, preaching universal love and the innocence of the senses. As he became accustomed to his new role, Manson began to dream of fame. He wanted to be somebody, an influence, like Bob Dylan or the Maharishi, the Indian mystic who, for a time, influenced and guided the Beatles. But all his efforts to become a singing star and launch a long-playing record came to nothing. He began to preach revolution, the overthrow of society, the destruction of the pigs and capitalists. He was the leader. His family accepted him almost as a kind of god. He had to do something to prove himself worthy of their devotion, and so he ordered his followers to commit murder. Of the pop musician Gary Hinman, of the film star Sharon Tate and her houseguests, and of the supermarket owner Lino LaBianca and his wife. In the second half of the 20th century, the pattern of murder seems to be changing. The Leopold and Loeb Superman murder, in which two young Chicago students went out and killed 14-year-old Bobby Franks for kicks, was labelled the crime of the century by the journalists of the 1920s. They found the case unique and without apparent motive. The killers came from wealthy families and had no obvious reasons for frustration. But seen in the light of Loeb's dominance over his more intellectual but less prepossessing partner, the crime and its motive becomes comparatively easy to comprehend. Curiosity, the desire for thrills, the need to prove themselves better and less bourgeois than their friends and relatives, drove them to murder. Without Loeb's nagging, jeering and ever-present superiority over him, it's doubtful if Leopold would ever have been anything more dangerous than a scholar too bright and insufficiently creative for his own and other people's good. The yearning to act in a criminal way would have been there, but he would never have acted alone. Our problem today, then, is to ensure, as far as possible, that the dominant one and the one who wishes to be dominated are kept apart. Until that's done, partnerships as deadly as those of Leopold and Loeb, Snyder and Gray, Brady and Hindley, will be a menace in our midst. A menace that could strike at any one of us, anywhere, and at any time.